The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got a little different show than typical, although they're becoming more common. Don't have Jim on the show with me today. My name is Chris. And instead, I've got Jake and Jacob from the office. So all three of us today got kind of a mixed bag of questions for the Q&A show. So we got both Jake and Jacob to join me today. Jim is off on his travels and was unavailable to record for this week. So I don't forget to do it, in case I don't mention it at the end of the show. I'll tell you right up front here how to submit questions for the show if you're interested. To submit those questions, you just email Jim directly. His email is jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And in the subject line, make sure you mention it's a question for the podcast. And it's always helpful to include a word or two about the topic that you're writing in about. Just makes it a little bit easier for Jim to categorize them. And sometimes we're looking for questions to cover on a particular topic, so it makes his searching for said questions a little bit easier. That's why I recommend you include that mention of the topic in the subject line of your email. And sometimes we cover questions that we've had for a while. Sometimes we don't get to your question. Either it's a question we've answered from others, or maybe it's not a good question for the podcast. What I mean by that is it's a question that is kind of not overly specific to you. There's some questions that are so personalized, that are so unique to you, that we don't think it applies to enough people to make it particularly interesting for a podcast, or maybe you don't supply enough information for us to give a useful answer to your question. But if it's a topic that a lot of people are interested in and you give us enough information about what you're wondering, we will likely get to your question at some point. And sometimes it's immediate. We try to always throw in at least one question that we've received recently, even though sometimes we're doing questions from a while back. So just wanted to let everybody know that. So with that, I'll bring in Jake. Looks like you're the first with your microphone unmuted. So thanks for joining me, Jake.
Hey, thanks for having me. And hello, everyone in podcast land. Happy to be here.
Yeah. And Jacob?
Hello. Hello. Glad to be back. Sounds like Jim gave us the reins for today, so we'll have some fun with it.
He did. He sent us the questions. Since obviously I ask everybody to send the questions to Jim, he's always going to be the one that's got them to send them over. Just so everyone knows, although a lot of the emails today don't really have hints for their state, but since we've all seen the questions, he had to forward them to us for us to cover. We're not going to play a competition between the three of us since we know the answers to any of the trivia questions about people's states. I think they're, glancing at this, there might only be one person.
Yeah,
it's just, actually, it's just the last question. So on that last question, I'll give everybody the hint for the state where the listener is writing from. And then when we're finished answering the question, I'll reveal the answer. So you can, I know there's a lot of people who like to play at home, try to guess the states. This was originally intended as a Stump Chris kind of a situation. I'm not sure how I'm always on the receiving end of that, but in this case, it'll just be Stump the Listener, if you will. Either of you have big plans for the weekend? I caught them off
guard. I don't, no. It's a pretty quiet weekend around here for me.
Yeah, nothing too wild here either. I think just getting together with some friends one of the days, but nothing really planned.
Okay, well, that could be good. Quiet weekend. I'm going to try to do a little camping. We've had kind of a busy summer, so we haven't been able to do it as much as normal. So I'm going to see if I can tackle that this weekend. And in town here, it's supposed to be approaching 100 again this weekend, so it's always a good time to go camping where it's 10 to 15 degrees cooler. Up in the mountains of Colorado. So I'll cross my fingers that that's what we run into. But without further ado, we'll dive in. We'll kind of keep with the tradition of doing some Social Security questions first. So I'll start here. This first question came in through our blog post. So longtime listeners will know not only do we have the podcast-focused website, TheRetirementAndIRAShow.com, all that run together, so TheRetirementAndIRAShow.com. But then we also have a Social Security-focused blog where we post articles about Social Security and answer people's questions, and you can submit questions through that as well, and that website is HelpWithMySocialSecurity.com. This person went there, submitted their question. It doesn't appear that they're a podcast listener, because they indicated they just Googled this question and ended up at our blog post. So it's a very short question, but it's going to allow me to talk a little bit about Social Security taxation. So the question is simply, I make $49,200 a year from Social Security, retired with no other income. What percentage of taxes do I need to have taken out for 2025? So ultimately, this is a question of, do they need to have withholding? Would it be appropriate for them to set up withholding from Social Security? And before I kind of get into that, I'm going to talk a little bit about Social Security taxation here. But at first, those of you who either are looking at having taxes withheld from your Social Security benefits, just know that you have essentially five options if you choose to have tax withholding done from your Social Security benefits. And those five options are 0%, 7%, 10%, 12%, and 22%. Those are the only five options you've got, and you can do that through the online portal or contacting Social Security. You can set that up and turn it on or turn it off. But you can't define your own amounts. It's essentially those five options that you've got. But this person's question is, do they need to bother doing that? And if so, how much? So let's review the taxability of Social Security. So Social Security initially was not taxed income tax wise, when you were receiving benefits. But as adjustments were made over time to Social Security, first in the 1980s and then again in the 1990s, there was a formula created essentially that would bring Social Security, at least a portion of your Social Security, into your taxable income, or I guess I should technically say into your 1040 is potentially taxable income. And those rules now that were, most recently established in the 1990s indicate that for a single person, if they've got what's called provisional income, and I'll define for you in a minute what that is, provisional income up to $25,000, they would not include their Social Security at all in their tax return as taxable income. Between $25,000 and $34,000 of this, sometimes people call it combined income, but provisional income is in the code usually, up to 50% of that Social Security benefit could be taxable. And then over $34,000 of this provisional income for a single filer, you could have up to 85% of your Social Security forced to be included on your 1040. For those filing jointly on a joint return, that joint couple up to $32,000, none of your Social Security would be considered on your taxable income. Between $32,000 and $44,000 up to 50%, and over $44,000 up to 85%. Now, those of you who aren't super familiar with this are probably already detecting this is getting a little complicated, right? And just know, as you hit each of those levels, it's not a cliff where suddenly, you know, you don't hit, for a married couple filing jointly, $32,000 of combined income and half of your Social Security becomes taxable. That's not how it works. It's essentially a graduated scale. And for those of you who have fun figuring these things out on their own with pencil and paper in a worksheet and maybe a calculator, you can refer to publication 915, IRS publication 915, for the 19-step worksheet that will ultimately determine how much of your Social Security is open to taxation, we'll call it. And the reason I'm saying that is just because a portion of your Social Security is going to be included in your gross income for taxation, you still might not owe any taxes. And so I'll explain that in just a moment. So those are the general rules on will my Social Security be taxable. Now, I'm not a big fan personally of using publication 915 and the manual worksheets, because it is a long step-by-step process, easy to make a mistake, and the form is somewhat confusing to a lot of people. So I prefer to use, some people have taken that worksheet and turned it into an online calculator. And there's quite a few of these out there. The IRS actually has one of their own. I don't think it's the easiest one to use. And there's a number, but I did just stumble on one. I know we were going to answer those questions today. So I always, you know, kind of look to see what's recently out there. And I ran across one today that, playing around with it, I really like. Now, I don't know. I'm familiar with this company because I've seen it before. It's a software company that does a lot of different things. But they set up a website that's simply called taxsocialsecurity.com. So all one word, taxsocialsecurity.com. And it's free. There's no ads on it. It's just super clean, which is one of the things I like about it. And my playing around with it, it looks like it's accurate, although I haven't tested all of its functionality. So I'm not going to vouch for it saying it's absolutely correct, but it appears to be consistent with Pub 915, and it's super easy to use. Now, again, there's a number of others. AARP, I think, still has one. Some of the big financial services companies, insurance companies even, put these out there for, you know, a benefit for people to use. But I really like this one that I ran across, like I said, just today. So on there, we can actually plug in to maybe answer this person's question to determine how much of that $49,200 a year they need to be worried about for tax purposes. So they don't say whether they're single or married. So I'm going to assume at this point that they're single. So I'm going to leave this calculator set at single and enter in that Social Security income of $49,200, just that. And they indicated that was their only income. So we're just going by what they shared. Now, you know, we don't know all the facts of their situation. So this is not specific advice for this person. I'm just saying, you know, if you went to this website, this calculator, this is what the numbers would look like. You need to verify this for your particular situation and not just, you know, trust this, because you just gave us this one sentence here. So this isn't necessarily for you. But if a hypothetical person that literally had just Social Security income of $49,200 in 2025, if I calculate the tax on that, it indicates that none of the Social Security would be considered taxable. Now, that's because that combined income, we call it, or provisional income, the formula is essentially this. It is, you include your AGI, so all of your income sources that would normally be on your 1040, except for Social Security. You leave that off initially. Take your AGI. You then add half of your Social Security, and then you add some things that normally are excluded for tax purposes, like tax exempt interest and a few other things that are don't apply to a lot of people. You can look up in Pub 915, kind of those add backs that we add back in. But it's mostly just your AGI plus any tax-free interest and half of your Social Security income. Well, their only income is the Social Security income. Half of the $49,200 is less than that $25,000 and that I mentioned before, which for a single person is the trigger where you could have up to half of your Social Security subject to taxation. And it appears zero of it would be. And not only that, even if some of the Social Security was taxable, let's assume they had a little bit more. Let's assume this person made in 2025 around the maximum that a person in 2025 could be receiving as a Social Security retirement benefit. That maximum is about $5,000 a month. It's a little north of there. The way someone can get to a Social Security benefit of over $5,000 a month is to have a, you know, a high Social Security benefit to begin with, and then have an weighted to 70 earning delayed retirement credits. It's actually, if a person like that could actually see a Social Security benefit in 2025 in excess of $60,000 a year. So if I change their number to 60,000 instead, now in this calculator indicates that 2,500 of that would be considered taxable Social Security income, or about 4.17%. Why so little? Because he's gone just a little bit over that 25,000 trigger, because half of 60,000 is 30. 30 is just a little bigger than 25. That $5,000, half of, 50% of that 5,000 in excess of the 25,000, not cliff, but trigger point that you've got mm-hmm. here, is going to be considered taxable. However, he still likely owes no taxes. Why? Because from that $2,500 of gross income now that's being on his 1040, you take the standard deduction or your itemized deductions if they're larger than that. And the standard deduction for someone 65 and older in 2025 is $17,000. Plus there's that new $6,000 bonus deduction that's in play until 2028. But even the $17,000 standard deduction that's available is well in excess of that $2,500 still would likely, would not owe any federal income taxes. So this calculator is super easy. You can put in a lot of different things. Let's say somebody's got a different scenario. Not only do they have $60,000 of Social Security income, they've got another $60,000 that they've taken out of their IRA. So they have another $60,000 of income on their 1040. Now, instead of 4% of their Social Security becoming taxable, they've exceeded the high trigger enough where 85% of their Social Security is now taxable. So for those of you kind of in the graduated, the phase out, or I guess phase in of taxability on your Social Security, be aware that as you add income, you might go from only 4% of your Social Security being taxable to 85% or somewhere in between, but it will max out the most of your Social Security that can be scraped over into the AGI of your 1040 is 85%. That is currently the cap. So instead of working through the sheet manually, it can be kind of messy. Find a good calculator that will look at this. So back to their point, if truly you've got under $50,000 worth of Social Security income, and that's your only source of income, you have no interest, no dividends, no nothing at all, just the Social Security, then by these calculations, a person in that scenario should owe no federal income taxes, so withholding would not be necessary. But this is a confusing piece, right? The taxability piece, we hear about it, but the formula gets a little messy if you're doing it by hand. And luckily, we have all these nice calculators, these online calculators. And this one, I appreciate. Not only does it give you how much is taxable, how much of your Social Security is going to be considered taxable, it then shows you what your anticipated tax burden would be, taking into consideration your standard deduction, or you can actually enter an itemized deduction amount if you've got it, and the One Big Beautiful Bill Act extra deduction if it applies to you if you're over the age of 65. Well, I guess 65 plus by the end of 2025. And it looks like it's correctly doing the phase out on the extra deduction. But this one's my new favorite until I just ran across it today. So you need to do your own due diligence, verify with your tax professional that any calculations it's making for you are correct. Right. So when you're doing your tax return itself, I wouldn't necessarily trust this without verifying. So trust and verify. But this looks to be a very handy a tool. And so it's, once again, taxsocialsecurity.com. Now, this is, I'm vouching, or at least recommending you consider this website on July 25th of 2025. These websites tend to change over time. So if you're listening to this podcast well after July of 2025, the website may not be in existence, might not work properly anymore. I might not recommend it anymore. Just that's my disclaimer on it. So I just wanted to mention it because it's the cleanest one and the easiest to use one I've run across in a really long time.
Yeah, I'd second that, Chris. I'm glad I'd not seen this before. You mentioned it today, and I agree with you. This is definitely better than the other ones I've seen.
Yeah, there's others that are pretty good, but they usually clutter it up with a whole bunch of words and ads and stuff like that. This is just so nice and clean and just gets to the point. Just goes right to the calculator.
Exactly.
And you're there. And I played around with some numbers and verified them against other calculators that I've used that I trust, and the numbers seem to match. Mm-hmm. So the limited testing I did, this seems to be legit. So appreciate these folks for putting this together. And it's from a company called Imagisoft out of Albuquerque, New Mexico. So appreciate it, guys, gals, whoever put it together. Okay. So sorry, kind of long on that one, but kind of the backbone of taxability of Social Security gets a little complex. The next one that I'll do real quick before I start including Jake and Jacob here is really a PSA on an ongoing observation that has happened about Social Security and the first payment you receive once you apply for benefits. The timing of that payment, I had received from a couple different people some surprising information about when they received that first payment. And so the little backstory is I keep hearing from people that their first payment they're receiving quicker, earlier than they expected. It was a good surprise that they had. They were expecting it at a certain time, and they got it earlier than that. So let me remind everybody of the general rule of how you are paid, when you are paid during the month for an earned benefit. So Social Security benefits are paid in arrears. That means, here we're recording this in July, people who are owed a July Social Security benefit are paid in the month of August. Specifically, Social Security runs these payments in batches. They do four batches generally every month on the first, second, third, and fourth Wednesday of each month. The first Wednesday is reserved for SSI, so not Social Security retirement benefits, but a lot of people call it welfare payments. So it's needs-based payments for people of any age, if you qualify. So those and related payments, and if you're collecting multiple payments, if one of them is one of those, then everything usually comes in that first Wednesday. But that's kind of reserved. That first Wednesday is reserved for that. For the vast majority of people receiving a standard Social Security retirement benefit, and this includes your own benefit, a spousal benefit, a survivor benefit, those are going to come on the second, third, or fourth Wednesday of each month. And they determine which applies to you by the day of the month you were born. So if you were born between the first and the 10th of the month, you get your payments on the second Wednesday of each month. From the 11th to the 20th of the month, if your birthday falls there, you're paid on the third Wednesday of each month. And then for those of you on the tail end, you get where I'm going with this. From the 21st to the end of the month, you are paid the fourth Wednesday of each month. And you'll know, it should be like clockwork, unless something a glitch or something goes wrong, that that payment is going to hit your bank the Wednesday that is defined by the day of the month that you were born. That's the standard. And that is how things have been going. There haven't been really surprises there, other than people, when they first apply, have been telling me multiple times, we got our first payment much earlier than what we thought. And here's another one. So this person writes in and says, Chris's review of first payment dates prompted me to comment. My wife was approved for her Social Security retirement payments via email and received her first payment on May 2nd, which is a little puzzling because May 2nd of 2025 was a Friday. I went and looked it up. Mm-hmm. At first, I thought maybe they batched it with the first Wednesday of the month, but it actually was on Friday. That was a bizarre one, but continues. Her birthday's on the 2nd of the month, so we were expecting the payment to show up on May 14th, which that makes sense. That's the second Wednesday of May this year, was the 14th, and being born between the 1st and the 10th, the full expectation was paid on the 14th. It wasn't until it failed to show on the 14th that I scrolled back to find it in my bank on May 2nd. So here's another case where they're saying that first payment after she signed up for benefits came early, about 12 days early. Also note that they put in here the turnaround time from the online application to approval for her was about 40 days. So they turned it around pretty darn quick. So I've been kind of looking into this. I've been hearing this to see, is there some official policy on this or what's going on? And what I think is happening, so I haven't gotten full confirmation of this. And if someone ever maybe who's connected to Social Security could confirm this that's out there, that would be great. But what I think is happening is when they first set up your claim, they have to manually put in your first payment. It isn't until the payments you've been approved and the payments are set up that then it goes on from that time forward forever, as long as you're collecting benefits, that you get put in those automatic batches, those three Wednesdays of the month. That first payment, I think they're setting up manually, and they're just, to be nice, I guess, they're setting it up in the first possible deposit batch that they can. And so I think that's what's happening, is that first payment gets scheduled manually and they're throwing it in as fast as possible. And so not everybody's going to get it early, because depending on the timing of when you apply and when it gets approved, fast as possible might be your normal payment date. Or if it's slow, might be after your normal payment date and you'll get it late that first time. But I've heard from people actually getting it early. But I think it's because that first payment they're scheduling manually. And it isn't until the second payment and beyond that now you're, quote, in the system and automatically, you know, dealt with. And it's getting that those batches that happen every single month. And then everything flows from that point forward. Because these other people I've heard from, this person didn't mention it, but these other people I've heard from say that the subsequent payments after the first one have been showing up as expected. On the Wednesday they expected to receive it. So just kind of an interesting thing that we've kind of learned from people giving us feedback. So I appreciate people writing in. If I probably don't need to hear that it's happening anymore, if that's simply it, but if you ever talk to someone or know someone, or maybe you are connected with Social Security and know enough behind the scenes can confirm what's happening, that would be something I would love to hear about. If you can confirm my suspicion that that's this manual process up front that's triggering this, but good to know.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah,
we need an inside connection.
We do, and I've had over the years occasionally the couple people I used to have that I could have probably quickly verified this with have either retired or moved on, no longer work at Social Security. There's a fair amount of turnover. Social Security. It's a very stressful place to work these days. Heavy workload, and something more complicated than people might imagine. Okay. So now I'm going to get Jake and Jacob more involved and get to our third question here. So this next question, it's a little long. I may not go through the whole thing. But this came in just 2-3 months ago. And in the subject line, they put asset positioning in the transition period. So that's the topic area that we're dealing with. No hint here, but he wrote in, said, I'm in the transition phase and plan to retire at the end of 2031. So this is on a little bit. And what he means by the transition phase is that phase, there's kind of two main phases in life financially. What we call the accumulation phase, which is what you'd expect when you're accumulating money, shoving money away, pursuing growth opportunities generally with investments. And then the distribution phase is obvious. Once you stop earning money, you've now got this nest egg built up and you're distributing it to live on. The whole reason why you built it up in the first place. But then the in-between, what we call the transition phase, where you don't have the time horizon to treat things as a full accumulator, searching for growth, maybe being invested simply for growth, but you haven't started distributing yet, but you just don't have the risk capacity to deal with volatility as you head approach your retirement or distribution phase. We call that the transition phase. So oftentimes people will change their investment style and their asset allocation and positions, we call them, in that transition phase for those reasons mm-hmm. and others. So that's what he means by transition phase. So I wanted to define that for people. He continues, from a financial perspective, we can retire sooner if we need to. We have well-funded, diversified portfolios, but likely not well-positioned for retirement. By positioning, I'm referring to time and purpose-based investing you espouse. And he's absolutely right. That's how we determine in our minds and on behalf of our clients that take our approach and our advice, that when you need the money and what it's needed for is very impactful or informative when deciding how we should have it invested or positioned. He says, I'd love to get your thoughts on my scenario, but I don't think it's covered in your 13-part series. Below is a snapshot. It gives some detail I don't know is super important. He's got a taxable account that's 70-30, stocks to bonds, tax-deferred account that's about 50-50, and a tax-free account that's 80% stocks to 20% bonds. So his maybe taxable, so brokerage account style, and his tax-free, generally Roth, are aggressive to moderately aggressive to aggressive, and his tax-deferred is always taxable, like IRA 401k money is about 50-50. He says, I may be significantly overfunding the fixed allocation part of my taxable portfolio. It covers 10 years of living expenses, both MDF and discretionary. One of my goals is to do Roth conversions in tax-efficient ways, as we have significant assets in tax-deferred, about $2 million. Given that, we likely won't take Social Security until 70. My questions, how best to protect principal between now and the start of 2032 when I'm retired? Even if it doesn't grow much, it should at least keep up with inflation. Your podcast does talk about positioning at the start of retirement, not during the transition period. Can you explain how this applies to the transition phase? I expect to always have about 2 years of funds for emergencies separate from this that would be in money market funds or equivalent. And secondly, at what point would you recommend working with a retirement planning group such as your group? I recall Chris saying about 3 years out from retirement's a sweet spot. I'm about 7 years away. On the other hand, if for some reason I have to retire sooner, we want to make sure we're well positioned. So before I turn this over to Jake and Jacob to comment on this, I'll address that because he called my name. I'll address the recommendation for that quote sweet spot. When we talk about doing planning, not just general planning, I'm not suggesting you don't do any planning until 3 years out. I'm talking doing a detailed retirement projection in order to look at things the way we do in our approach with minimum dignity floor and looking at secure income, your fund vision, to be able to rely on those projections, we need to have pretty reliable numbers. And if you're too far out, not sure of what you're wanting to do in retirement, maybe not even sure where you're going to live, things like that, then we don't have the data to do the kind of projections that we like to do. So when I say within 3 years, that's the type of analysis I'm talking about, is our detailed projections that we do. Within about 3 years, we pretty much know what you've got, right? You've accumulated most of what you're going to have the last 3 years. You can see some changes, but now we've got a pretty clear view of what you're going to have on day one of retirement as far as resources. You've got a pretty good idea of what you're spending on things, and you've probably, or if you have a spouse or significant other, you've decided the types of things you want to do, particularly early in retirement, for fun. So you can help us put together a budget for you there so we can understand your goals in that regard. That all seems to work really well within about 3 years. When you get out 5 or 7 years, then you start to increase the number of, gee, we're not sure about this. There's some more unknowns. What you're going to have as far as resources on day one of retirement gets less reliable. It just starts to kind of get more mushy, I call it. So that's where my 3-year recommendation comes from. Not that you shouldn't do other types of planning at other times as appropriate, but just, you know, our specific kind of detailed projections to do our thing, the way we talk about it constantly on the podcast, I think within 3 years, or even in, you know, or you're into retirement. If you're, we work with a lot of people that they've already been retired, right? And they just want to tighten things up and clear some things up. They think they're okay, but they're not sure. So within 3 years and on into retirement are good times to do our style of planning, is what I'm talking about there. Okay. So that said, Jake, he mentioned doing some conversions. He said one of his goals is to do Roth conversions in a tax efficient way. I'll have you do that first. And I'll have Jacob talk a little bit about his numbered question about how to protect principal for the next 7 or 8 years or so. So Jake, what do we usually recommend on the Roth conversion idea?
Yeah, I can give kind of an overview here based on, you know, what he gave us. You know, I think a couple things come into play when you're thinking about Roth conversions. And one of them obviously is your current asset mix, which he gave us a glimpse into. It looks like he's probably been a fairly high earning person. And so most of his money is in tax deferred and taxable, not as much into Roth, which makes sense and is not atypical. So he's looking to bring down those, what we call always taxable, you know, 401k, 403b, IRA style assets, probably to reduce RMDs when the time comes. And that's one thing we would look at in a projection is, based on, you know, a multitude of inputs, including assumed rates of return, as well as your spending and where assets may come to cover that spending, what is a potential for those always taxable, tax-deferred assets to grow to by the time you reach RMD age, which for this person is still quite a ways off. If, you know, 2031, they're going to be 65. RMDs wouldn't start until 75 based on current law. But it's totally reasonable to consider Roth conversions once your income stops from employment, usually until and maybe even through you start Social Security, where your income is essentially determined by either selling assets in a brokerage account and potentially realizing some gains there, or distributing funds from always taxable accounts, obviously is going to go towards your earned income, or not earned, but your AGI for that year. So the best way to do this, and maybe not the best, but a way that seems to make the most sense for most people is to, again, there's other things that come into factor, like potential inheritance and stuff like that I'm going to ignore for now, but would be to do an analysis. We favor to do it later in the year, kind of in the fall, October, November timeframe, to figure out what is my kind of income from all sources projected to be for this tax year. And when I say income from all sources, I'm thinking about things like taxable interest, any dividends and the taxability of those dividends, whether qualified or ordinary, any capital gains or capital losses, have occurred through the year from your brokerage account, any potential capital gain distributions that we can anticipate for those of you that hold kind of mutual funds in those brokerage accounts. That can sometimes spit off very sizable capital gains right at the end of the year, you know, December 29, 30, 31 is when a lot of those come out. And so try to estimate what those are going to be. Once we get a picture of kind of your income from all sources throughout the year, we can kind of check that, do kind of a pro forma tax return. And then based on that information and the anticipated kind of longer term tax projection, you know, may not be completely known, but we can have an idea based on account sizes. What would be a reasonable tax bracket that you would like to target, you know, in this year? You know, with the OBBB being passed recently, you know, maybe now that the 24% bracket is going to be the 24% bracket, at least for the foreseeable future, for a lot of people, that's an attractive bracket to do conversions in, especially if you, you know, had been in the 35 or 37% income bracket throughout most of your career. All of a sudden paying tax at, you know, 24% doesn't seem so bad, especially if the longer term outlook shows that you're going to be in a potentially higher bracket when those RMDs start, if you do nothing, right? No conversions, no distributions from those accounts. So the thing to do is to look at this on an annual basis with kind of an eye to that longer term strategy, but to try to predict, you know, for the next decade, here's the exact amount I want to do in Roth conversions every year is probably not worth the effort that would be, because it's going to be wrong anyways, because you can't predict your income from year to year, especially if you've got a lot of, you know, investment outside of retirement assets that is throwing off various income sources every year. So annual look, figure out where do you want to target this year, with an eye to the tax bracket, as well as the potential IRMA impact if you're over 65 on Medicare. That's, you know, that's kind of a way that we like to look at this.
Great. Yeah. The point to the, you know, looking at this every year and doing that reconciliation is important, and not to, whether you're using your own calculations or some type of online resource that's to giving you a projection of what conversions you might do over a period of time, those we find fall apart pretty quickly when the realities of each year kind of appear. So Jacob, what about his question about, he's in the transition period and he realizes, you know, he doesn't want to suffer usually what we call sequence of returns risk at this point, that as he approaches retirement and maybe enters into retirement, doesn't want to have all his money volatile, whether it's stocks or bonds, both in this day and age can be volatile for different reasons and different degrees, obviously. But how do we look at that? How might he look at protecting some of that with what he called principal protection?
Right. Yeah. I mean, a couple of ways to kind of look at this and a couple of different options, right, that we would kind of tend to look at, right? Obviously, you know, none of these being specific kind of recommendations. Definitely go out and do your due diligence and see kind of which options maybe work best for you, which ones you feel the most kind of comfortable with, right? But I think he's thinking about this correctly in the sense that, hey, you know, like we always talk about, right, nobody's going to, you know, need all of their money on day one of retirement, right? In 2032, when this gentleman retires, right, I wouldn't expect it to need all his money. Certainly a portion of it could be kind of needed. So I think he's thinking about it correctly when he's kind of saying, hey, at least for a portion of this, right, I want to kind of prioritize maybe downshifting it, putting into something with kind of full principal protection on the downside. Maybe it's helping him from an emotional standpoint as he nears retirement to kind of acknowledge, hey, you know, whatever's going on in the markets, whatever's going on in the broader kind of, you know, media or landscape, right? Having money that's specifically set aside and fully principally protected, you know, investments or offerings that is not going to largely fluctuate with what's going on in the market, right? Really tends to kind of help people as they near retirement in this kind of transition phase. And so, you know, a couple of general kind of ideas that, you know, I would encourage them to kind of do the due diligence on and kind of research would be things like brokered CDs, right, at his custodian or at a bank, but more likely than not, these would probably be in an investment account at a custodian. He doesn't say exactly what he is. I know we pick on, you know, Vanguard people all the time, so let's just pretend it's at Vanguard, right? You can look inside Vanguard and they will have a list of different kind of what they call brokered CDs, which are very, very similar to kind of bank CDs with a couple small kind of caveats there, but they're essentially just like any other bank CD held for a specific term, right? They're fully kind of protected on the downside. You know, if you hold it for that full term, you're going to get your principal and whatever interest they were kind of promising, you know, over that term or that time period that you were kind of holding it. The one thing I'll make sure to mention with those, right, is just beware of kind of the FDIC insurance, right? If you keep it below kind of a $250,000 per bank per account limit, right, you're kind of guaranteed to have that FDIC insurance on, you know, almost all kind of CDs on the brokered platform. So that would be one kind of option, right? He mentions inflation in here as being kind of the one thing. He says, you know, it doesn't have to grow significantly, right? But at least kind of keep pace with inflation. One of the, you know, air quote, you know, benefits, I guess, of interest rates going up over the last couple of years, as opposed to where they were over the last 10, 15 years, has been the ability to get a little bit more interest, right, on some of these principally protected products. So on CDs, and again, keep in mind, folks, we're talking, you know, end of July, 2025, you know, right now we're seeing kind of 1 year CD rates, 18 month CD rates, 20 or 2 year CD rates, right around the 4.1 kind of percent ballpark, right? So that'll change depending on what interest rates do, but that at least gives you an idea of kind of where you could assume, you know, a rate of interest would be on kind of a 1 to a 2 year CD at this point. So that could be a good kind of option for them. Another one, right? If you wanted to kind of take a CD and, you know, put it on steroids, I guess, if you will, right? Could be something like a multi-year guaranteed annuity, a MYGA, right? Where you're essentially just locking up the money with an insurance company for a set period of time, whether it's 2, 3, 4, 5 years. You know, 3, 4, 5 years are typically kind of the most popular ones that I would say we work with folks on. But you're essentially just locking up that money, getting full principal protection, and guaranteeing, you know, a specific rate of interest compounding every year for a specific period, whether it's 3, 4, or 5 years. And I'd have to double check with Greg in the office because he's the kind of the insurance guy. I don't know exactly what MYGAs are kind of offering from an interest standpoint right now with where we sit. But last time I checked with him, it was kind of around the 5% or so ballpark. So a little bit more, you know, annual interest that you could get in a MYGA as opposed to something like a CD. But you have to kind of keep in mind, right? Number one, generally to get that higher rate of interest, the MYGA is going to be a slightly longer hold than the CD would. And then number two, right, a little bit less liquidity, I would say, in the MYGA than something like the CD. The CD, although you know, I would encourage this gentleman to kind of earmark it to be held for the full term. Theoretically, if they did want to sell out of a brokered CD in the middle of the term, that is something you can kind of do at your custodian. You just have to be wary that depending on what the interest rate environment is, right, you might sell out of it and get slightly more than the principal you put in, or you might get slightly less than the principal you put in, depending on what interest rates are doing at that moment in time. So there is a little bit of flexibility on brokered CDs as far as if you had to access that money in the middle of the term. MYGA, a little bit more difficult, right? Most MYGAs, and it depends on the insurance carrier, right? But some of them will offer, you know, 10% free withdrawal amounts every year, but generally they're a little bit harder to get at in the middle of the term if you did try to kind of access the money. So that's generally why they can offer, right, a little bit higher rate of interest is kind of those two caveats. So from a pretty straightforward full principal protected standpoint, right, if this gentleman's comfortable locking up the money for 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years, right, again, he's kind of looking at a 6 to 7 year time horizon that he wants to kind of keep in mind. Those are options that could be kind of applicable and that might, you know, strike a chord with them. The other thing that could, you know, or a couple of other options, I guess, the first one we'll talk about is one that we've talked about on the podcast previously, which is something like the 100% kind of full downside protected buffered ETFs, right? Those are those products. Again, I'm not going to get too into the weeds on today's episode about how they function specifically. There's other episodes where you can go back and kind of look at them. But these are, you know, buffered ETFs that kind of have a 12-month point-to-point period. The performance of these is tied to generally the price change in the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100 are kind of the two underlying indexes that we see the most popular for the full 100% principally protected buffered ETFs. And these are funds where rather really the options you're weighing is saying, hey, rather than locking in, you know, a 4% interest rate on a 1 year CD in this buffered ETF, you're giving yourself a little bit more ability to participate on the upside. The cap rates on these funds are right now anywhere from about, I would say, 6 to kind of 7% on the 100% buffer. So you're kind of just saying, hey, you know, if I feel like the markets are kind of going to do well or at least reasonably well over the next kind of year or so, I'd rather have the ability to get, you know, maybe the first 6-7% rise in something like the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100 versus guaranteeing a 4% rate of interest on, you know, something like a CD, right? But keep in mind, on the buffered ETF, you're not guaranteed anything, right? So if the markets are down, you know, the maximum that you could lose on those funds is just the fee of the fund itself. That's that full downside protection, right, kicking in. But on the upside, right, if the S&P or the NASDAQ 100 were to return, you know, 2-1% in a specific kind of 12-month period, you know, that's the percentage of return that this person would kind of be looking at in the buffered product. So you kind of have to weigh, you know, do I want the ability to participate in a little bit kind of more upside, or do I want to kind of guarantee a specific rate of interest with where things sit right now? So those are kind of three options. The only other one I'll spend a little bit of time on here and make mention of is, again, another kind of fund option that we've talked about in the past, which is kind of those defined maturity treasury bond funds or TIPS bond funds, right? Treasury inflation protected securities, right? The only reason I mention them here is specifically because this listener listed, you know, hey, I wanted to make sure that it keeps pace with inflation, right? If he truly wanted to guarantee that it keeps pace with inflation, he could look at something like these defined maturity TIPS ETFs, where you've got a specific maturity date. If he's looking at saying, hey, I might need this money at the start of 2032, right? He could simply say, I'm going to buy the TIPS fund, right, that's maturing in October of 2031, right, a couple months before the money could potentially be needed. And by doing that, he's essentially kind of laddered out that money into a TIPS ETF, guaranteeing, you know, that he does actually keep pace with whatever inflation is ends up being over the next kind of 6-7 year window, if you will. So if that's his biggest concern and saying, hey, you know, I'm not going for the moon here, I just want to guarantee that I keep pace with inflation, the TIPS defined maturity funds might be something that's appealing to him as well. So a lot of, you know, a lot of options out there nowadays with where interest rates are at for this full kind of principally protected money. Couple of things to kind of consider and weigh, you know, as far as, you know, the liquidity, the interest rate, you know, what you want to kind of tie the performance to. So it's a good environment, I would say, to be looking at the different principally protected funds out there, because there's a lot of kind of compelling offerings based on where interest rates are at, where cap rates are at, et cetera, kind of going forward. So again, you know, I would encourage him, go out, do the due diligence, kind of do some of the research on these products and concepts kind of broadly. Definitely not recommending one over the other specifically, but you know, those are all the kind of the options that we would look at on our side to kind of say, hey, you know, let's prioritize full downside protection for dollars that are needed maybe, you know, 6 years from now, essentially in this case.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks, Jacob.
One thing I thought was interesting about this is he said that in his taxable portfolio, he already has 10 years of living expenses. I'm assuming that's in some sort of
fixed
bond
income
allocation.
He said in bonds. Yeah.
I mean, if that's true, again, depending on the type of bond and what interest rate they're exposed to. But if he just kind of transitioned that piece into what Jacob was talking about, I mean, 10 years MDF plus discretionary is, it's pretty good protection.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And you might not even, you know, this gets into what we've talked about previously too, right? You know, when you're looking at 10 years worth of spending, you know, maybe you only look at, you know, principally protecting that first 1 to 5 years, and then that year's kind of 6 through 10, you get more into the concept of the degree of principal protection, right? That Jim's always talking about, where maybe you say, hey, you know, I don't need full downside protection. I don't need to specifically lock in a set rate of interest, right? Maybe we look at something with a little bit more upside, still giving you a decent amount of downside protection, something like one of those 20% buffered ETFs, right? It all varies based on, you know, their risk tolerance and what he ultimately wants to kind of achieve. But definitely, yeah, good thing to kind of point out there, Jake, for sure.
Yeah, and that actually kind of ties in a little bit to the next question, which is also on positioning. So this question also came in about the same time, just a few months ago. Says, you talk about positioning, and I'm 2 years from retirement, so I'm trying to figure out how to position at least the first few years into retirement at this time. What I need support on is how you position in multiple accounts. I think I have similar setups with Roth, traditional brokerage, and 401k, but still finding it difficult to assign and position some in each account and how much in each account. Do I need to figure out how much I'll spend from each type of account and then figure which exact account and then position at that point? This seems complicated and would involve some tax planning years out. Do you have recommendations on how to do this? So the reason I say this is related is this isn't a question on what are some options for principal protection, but it's how do I decide how much principal protection and in what account do I set up this principal protection, Roth, traditional brokerage, etc. So what do you guys think about that as far as determining it? He mentioned, you know, how much you'll spend from each type of account, which is heading down the path that we like. But why don't you expand on how maybe, Jacob, you help people determine the amount of positioning and where you position it.
Right. And this is a difficult question in a sense where I think, you know, we see this all the time, right, with both listeners and, you know, clients that we kind of work with, where it's really hard not to kind of struggle and kind of try to overanalyze this and really get into the weeds and, you know, plan this out. Everybody's a planner, right? If you're listening to the show, you know, you've been doing your own planning. Most likely you've been looking at this for the last, you know, 40, 30 years, right? And you want to kind of plan as you get closer to retirement, exactly what needs to kind of happen going forward. And unfortunately, in just reality of the way things exist, right, it's not really feasible or possible to sit down and say, okay, I know exactly which style of account, which investment I'm going to use for the next, you know, 10 years of spending, right? We can kind of try to get a jumping off point and get as close as we can. Jim always, you know, jokes and says, right, getting on the target might not necessarily be on the bullseye. I would say that would be kind of be the goal there as well. Another Jimism, right, that he always kind of says is, right, when you're starting to do some of this positioning and laying out some of these investments and which style of accounts you want to earmark some of the spending in, a lot, you know, this is all going to be etched in jello, right? Not stone, meaning you're not going to be dogmatic about this. You might start with having, you know, you're spending in a Roth IRA, right, to give you the tax flexibility. But maybe in reality, when you get to that year and you're starting to spend down some of those dollars from a tax perspective, it makes sense to do something else. So all that being said, right, this really kind of brings us back to the concept that we talk about revolving around that liquidity account, right? And then the liquidity account in our eyes is really, you know, a pool of money that you can access and spend from as you enter retirement that really doesn't have any tax implications associated with it, right? So in our eyes, it could be simply bank cash, you know, just cash in a liquid kind of bank account. It could be dollars that are liquid inside of a Roth IRA, right? If you're able to withdraw from a Roth IRA tax-free without any implications there, or it could be money in a maybe taxable brokerage style of account that's in kind of a cash-like, more principally protected style of fund, right? And so the reason we like this concept and the reason that we've kind of felt that this is the best way to kind of approach it, at least as you kind of enter retirement, is if you have, you know, a couple years worth of anticipated spending in this liquidity account of one sort or another, right, it allows you just to, one, emotionally, as you get into retirement, it's easier that we found for folks to continue to actually spend and enjoy themselves as they enter retirement to just continue to spend from this liquid account, generally, you know, let's say cash for the most part, right? Emotionally, I think that helps folks as they enter retirement rather than having to worry about taking an IRA distribution or getting a hold of their advisor to sell something to take an IRA distribution, right? If you have the flexibility and you have the money liquid, it's just easier to spend from and start to kind of progress throughout retirement by spending from cash there. The other benefit, and this is going to tie into probably what Jake will touch on here as well and what he touched on that last question, is if you're able to spend right from this liquidity account with no kind of tax consequences throughout the year, what that allows you to kind of do is every fall, like Jake was saying, look at your tax picture for that specific year and say, hey, okay, I spent down X amount of dollars from my liquidity account this year, but because I didn't have any tax burden to do that, I wasn't taking IRA distributions and ordinary income, right? I've got a pretty big tax planning window, let's just say, for that year. So what's the most efficient way from a tax perspective for me to start refilling some of that liquidity account and that money that I spent down this year, right? And so that could be, you know, it could be conversions or like Jake said, right? Maybe it makes sense in a specific year to realize, you know, long-term capital gains in a specific year. Could make sense to actually take an IRA kind of distribution each year. So in general, I would encourage this listener, I know it's, you know, it's harder than it sounds, right? We're making it sound like it's easy to kind of do. And by no means does everybody even have the flexibility to kind of have this liquidity account as they enter retirement. Some folks, right, if you don't have the cash, you don't have the liquidity in a Roth IRA or a brokerage account, you might have to take distributions from an IRA as you enter retirement. And that's okay, but you just need to look from a tax perspective to say, okay, how can I start to maybe build up this liquidity account so that in years going forward, I provide myself with a little bit more kind of tax flexibility to start refilling it each year in the fall in the most efficient manner possible. So conceptually, that's how I encourage you to look at it. But you know, Jake, did I miss anything there? Anything you wanted to kind of chime in on that?
I thought you nailed it. I think that's really the best way to do it. I would say oftentimes, and this is where the annual kind of tax planning comes into effect, is it could be a combination, right? It could be a combination of, you know, distributing from an IRA or doing a Roth conversion or realizing some capital gains and distributing some from an IRA. And then maybe you're targeting a tax bracket and your projected spending is, you know, higher than. That's where having some money positioned within a Roth can kind of also give you the opportunity to move some of that, those well-positioned Roth dollars into your liquidity account without a tax impact. So I think the positioning really plays hand in hand with kind of some ongoing tax planning and then just really deciding between those three different style accounts that this listener mentioned is how many, I guess, years of principal protection between those accounts do I want to have? And then it's just a refill the liquidity account every year and then do your tax planning at the end of the year to kind of fill in that back end of whatever you're needing based on the amount of, you know, your risk capacity and risk tolerance for how many years of principal protection you want.
Yeah. And always remember, it's going to be very difficult and you'll have paralysis by analysis if you try to dial in, oh, this year I'm going to take exactly this number of dollars from this account, so I need to position it this way in preparation for that. For the current year, maybe next year, that might be somewhat usable information, but things change over time. You have to react to how the markets have changed, how tax laws might have changed. Yeah. So this is really a case where the people who can navigate these waters the easiest are those with tax flexibility. So when you're defining your positions, and I do think, you know, defining the positions by what you intend to spend, right? How much you intend to distribute at time is a key factor in deciding how much that you need. Not dollars that you're not going to need for 15 years, you're going to look at very different than the dollars you're going to spend next year to go on vacation. But trying to predict the next 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 7 years of exactly which accounts are going to be drained at what time, you could probably, with enough analysis, get a ballpark. But I think if you just instead, it's much easier to create flexibility, having access to principal protected dollars with all, you know, both tax consequences, tax-free and taxable. Then when the time comes, you can kind of flex using this liquidity account to begin with, and then, you know, flex and adjust because you have the flexibility built in. So think the word flexibility is your savior here.
Yeah. Love it.
Okay. So let's see. Got another one here. And this one's, let's see about Roth conversions. So this one came in actually very recently, just yesterday. So he sent us a fresh one. My base AGI in retirement without Roth conversions is over $75,000 as a single filer. This year, my AGI is projected at $126,000 because I already did a $30,000 Roth conversion. How does one think about the value of an additional Roth conversion in the lower income period in retirement versus no Roth conversion to maintain a low income to get the highest extra senior deduction? So the one big beautiful bill is what he's talking about. Next year, my AGI will be much less without Roth conversions, but 2026 will be the last year before RMDs kick in. RMDs will cause me to go above the phase out for the extra senior deduction. So he's, I got some good questions here, but unfortunately he's, before I throw it to you guys to talk about, he's missing a couple things, details that will impact the decision. One is whenever considering tax strategies, which would include Roth conversions, what are you trying to accomplish? What is your tax priority? Is it all about you while you're alive and kind of managing your taxes for your own personal benefit? without regard to who will inherit money you leave behind, if there is any? Or is it a priority for you to, you know, the zero? He doesn't have the two, at least now. That could always change. But he's in a one situation now, and, you know, what does the zero matter to him? So the strategy and the aggressiveness on conversions can differ depending on the priority there. So the first thing that's missing here is a priority. And then also, you know, how big are the RMDs? How, you know, what kind of tax situation is he facing once the, he mentions RMDs kick in and he gets phased out from the extra senior deduction, but he could have huge RMDs or just, you know, modest RMDs and be in that category. And that would really change the attractiveness of things. So, we're not going to be able to maybe Jake just share some ways of thinking about this. But in his particular case, we actually have no way of giving him an idea of how aggressive he should be because we don't know his priority and we don't know really the makeup of his assets and how, you know, how bad his RMDs are going to be.
Right. Yeah. That's one of the downsides of trying to do this on a podcast. I guess if we assume that, you know, listener, writer, person who wrote this email, when you're looking at your kind of overall situation and didn't he say he's like 2 years away from RMDs? Yeah. So like Chris said, you can figure out what that estimated RMD is going to be and what tax bracket will that put you in. And if it's going to put you in a bracket that's maybe one or two brackets higher than you'd be doing these conversions, then I think it would probably make sense, again, not knowing your priorities, to do the conversions. And then if you're still within that phase out, then cool. If not, I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, I'd be more interested in saving on future taxes based on what we know, at least for the next handful of years, of what tax rates are going to be. If it's on the other hand, if you've got some more flexibility in there, then a more detailed kind of, you know, annual tax planning analysis is probably warranted. And see, what is that sweet spot? What's that kind of, you know, it doesn't have to be all or none. It could be a combination, but it really kind of depends on what those balances are, what your potential RMDs are going to be, and who we're trying to tax plan for. So that's what I would say to that.
Yeah. So let me see if I can find one more good question here. Okay. Here's one. This one fairly recently about Irma. And this is the one with the state hint. So I'll give the hint to everybody. And we are in the state that has the most lighthouses. Knowing the answer, it's not the state I would have guessed. But
that's a surprising one.
Yeah. So I'll reveal after we're done answering this question. So here's their question. I'll retire in 2 years at age 70 and claim Social Security. Per the SSA.gov website and adding 2 years of COLA and usual annual 8% increases, our combined checks, those due to delayed retirement credits, our combined checks will approach $100,000 a year total. So this total Social Security, about $100,000. I have $2 million in my Roth IRA and $1 million in my traditional. Since age 60, I've been doing annual Roth conversions. We started Medicare at 65, but because of my work income and those Roth conversions, we've been in the very highest IRMA bracket. So they've been paying a bunch for their Medicare. Mm-hmm. Now the question, I'd love to stop paying IRMA at retirement at age 70. Let's assume the first IRMA cliff for couples, now 212, increases to 240. So just so you know, those tiers, those brackets we call them, they look a little bit like tax brackets, increase with inflation. And in 2025, the first IRMA trigger is right about 212 for married, might be
based
exactly
on 223 income,
based on your 2023 income. But if you're collecting or you're on Medicare in 2025, it's that 212 number they're going to be using, but based on your income from two tax years prior. Exactly correct, Jake. He's saying, assume it's 240 in 2 years. In order to stay below that cliff, my traditional IRA withdrawal should be the IRMA cliff minus Social Security amount. So 240 minus the 100. Now, he's talking about his predicted income at 70. that income is actually going to be for 2 years after that. So right. Now that being said, with retirement, he'll be able to file an SSA 44 and use current year. So just, you know, his numbers do kind of make sense, because if he's assuming he's going to do that, his 2 years, his 2027 income, Maggie, can be used for his 2027 Irma. So right. His figures, he's, let's say the 240, he's going to fill 100 of it with his Social Security, leaving about 140 that he could take from a traditional IRA. He says, then we pay no Irma. Our marginal tax rate will be 22. So we'll end up with 210 after taxes. However, we need 264 to cover MDF and fun. Yes, we're big spenders with travel and grandkids, so we'll have to tap into the Roth. He says, what's better? Plan A, limit traditional IRA withdrawals to avoid Irma and tap into the Roth for the rest of your needs. Or plan B, don't touch the Roth and let it grow, what I'd call traditional treatment of the Roth. Take as much as we need from the traditional IRA and just pay the damn Irma, he said. So he is, again, in this email, we're missing one element that would be helpful. And that is his tax priority number for tax strategies. That two, what we call the 210. Is he mostly concerned with taxes for the couple and Irma for the couple? Is he particularly sensitive to taxes and Irma for a single survivor? Or is he focused on the zero? Who the beneficiaries may be kids that are going to receive this money. And people often ask, why are people worried about the zero? Well, if your kids are, you know, anesthesiologists or surgeons or own their own business and make a bunch of money or, you know, whatever. I'm just throwing options out there with high earning potential. And there's a lot of them, you know, don't feel excluded if I didn't list you, but they're super successful and in the top tax bracket, it might make every sense in the world for him to be converting at 22 or 32 or, you know, fill in the blank below the top tier. If it's likely those dollars are going to go to the kids. Now, the parents are going to be paying Irma along there, so you got to factor that in as well. And Irma can be very significant. The top tier of Irma is very punitive. Very, very punitive. It's big dollars here, and that effectively you consider as additional tax. So we don't know that. However, Jake, before I let you, yeah. You know, for you to comment, he mentions he's got $2 million in a Roth and $1 million in a traditional IRA. So his, you know, two-thirds Roth, one-third traditional, which is kind of atypical. But how do you think he should think about this?
Well, first of all, kudos to you, listener. I mean, you've been doing these conversions, and you're actually in a pretty – you didn't mention any other, like, brokerage or held-away cash or anything. But to have two-thirds of this portfolio in Roth already gives you just tremendous flexibility. Because you can always take distributions from that account, with, you know, tax free, which is, you know, ideal when you're trying to do this kind of annual tax planning in retirement. So I would, you know, again, I don't think it has to be an all or none, you know, again, not knowing your tax ordering number. But if you're looking to, it looks like your back of the napkin math are saying, well, hey, I need another, $55,000 roughly.
Right.
In order to cover our spending. Yeah, I would say, again, I know this is like the broken record here, but, you know, dialing this in each year, again, don't forget about other investment income that could be muddying the waters, but we'll take your email at face value and assume you don't have any, just your Social Security income. I think, yeah, I would probably just go up to that first IRMA tier and take any additional needs probably from Roth, again, not knowing the whole story here. But you do have a ton of flexibility. So you've got options, and you don't have to do the same thing every year either. Your spending needs can and will change. It could be more, it could be less. But just knowing that if you don't want to go into that IRMA, you don't need to. Again, even when you're, you know, you also want to keep an eye on those, you know, potential RMDs that are coming. Let's see if they're going to be 70 in 2 years. Means they're public math. When are they born? 57?
57, yeah.
So their RMDs are going to begin at age 73. So that'll be another thing. But even,
Yeah, but there's only a
at that
million
point,
in
they're not
there.
going to be massive.
Right.
Out of $1 million again, assuming it doesn't grow. But yeah, I kind of like your train of thought. I'd probably go lean towards plan A with a caveat of who are we tax planning for?
Yeah, and I'd have a hard time actually imagining for kids once you factor in Irma at significant levels, although he's only got a million more to go, but
Right.
doing continued, I would, and this is water under the bridge, you can't undo it. So you, and the fact that this happened doesn't change your forward-looking tax strategy. So always know this: the fact that you paid or didn't pay taxes in the past doesn't impact how you manage your taxes going forward, because that's water under the bridge, what we call a sunk cost. That's done. So just because you might potentially, looking back, have regrets having done it, that doesn't mean you change what you do. You do the best with what you've got moving forward. I would, with his balance being two-thirds Roth, one-third traditional, I usually see people getting into a very manageable situation for both Irma and taxes over their life. Once they hit about 50-50, and he's swung the pendulum significantly farther than that, I would suggest that in hindsight, he's probably overconverted.
Maybe. Yeah.
So not for sure. That's, you say maybe,
But
I
they're in
say
the highest Irma
probably,
bracket, I
right?
guess,
With the
depending on the
highest
rate.
Irma bracket, if you look at the effective tax rate he paid on those conversions, it's very high for the past few years since they've been hit with Irma. It's very high. So, but water under the bridge, doesn't matter.
Right.
But at this point going forward, unless you have a really compelling reason to prioritize the zero, right? The two and the one should be in great situation to use that 2 million you've now built up as a war chest of tax-free money in the Roth to manage your way for the rest of your lives out of Irma and out of unattractive tax brackets. You could maybe even, looking at it, unless you really want to protect Roth for an inheritance, you might be able to swim most of your life in the 12,
Right.
honestly, looking at this. So,
Yeah, that would be something to look at because I mean, they're already assuming, at least they told us, we're taking 140K out of the IRA anyways to spend. Where do we get the next 55? You
Well,
may not
that's
need to
their
take
assume. Yeah,
140K.
exactly. That was my point. Cause 55 grand, let's say that 2 million Roth, if we just for a rule of thumb, judge a reasonable withdrawal from that 4%, that's 80 grand. They were
Yeah,
talking of
it's
only taking
80,000.
54. You could take pretty healthy distributions from that Roth, maybe not keeping you out of the 22 completely, but of tracking this in life that you assume and that you should be filling the 22. Or filling up to the first Irma tier, which is a little shy of the top of the 22 bracket, but they're really close, right? I don't think you need to get that close. Plus, you're running danger that you go over and by a dollar, and you end up with Irma when you could have easily stayed away from it. So I'd stay well away from that Irma tier. But you may not need to go that deep unless, again, your priority is inheritance in the Roth. And you want to protect that and let that grow as much as possible. But if it's there for your benefit, for the two of you, and you prioritizing the two of you probably shouldn't be doing any more Roth conversions, unless there's more to the story, right? Jake already made that disclaimer, and I'll say it again. Given what we've been given, if that's the whole picture, then you might not need to do any more. If there's a big brokerage account or something he didn't think he needed to mention or something like that, that changes the metrics. Or other things, maybe, a pension or a inheritance coming in that some, who knows if there's more to the story, you need to consider those things. But given what he gave us, I think he's built up a big enough tax-free war chest to really benefit him if he uses it now and doesn't keep storing it up and building it through more conversions. But again, you should run some numbers, take a look at it. Look not just at this year, but off into the future. Events that are going to happen, which is what he's doing. He's looking at a couple of years when he retires, when RMDs kick in at 73, that type of thing. So, yeah, I think he's looking at the right things, but he And he says he wants to stop paying Irma. I think he can.
Yeah.
If that's the goal. I think he's paid his penance and he can now stay away from it. So.
Right. I would agree. Yeah. Not knowing the whole picture, but right. What you sent us, I think you're in good shape.
Exactly. Okay. Well,
so where are they from?
Thank you for prompting. I would have forgotten. So again, the hint was this is the state with the most lighthouses. And the answer is Michigan, which mm-hmm. surprised me. I was thinking, I don't know, Maine or some of that Florida. Area. But yeah, even Florida, talk about
so much coast.
So much coastline, Texas even.
Yeah.
But
I guess
Michigan.
I mean, they got a good chunk of, half the state, not quite as on.
Yeah.
Lake Michigan. You've also got, whatever one's on the other side, Lake Erie or Huron, I can never remember. And then Superior is, Lake Superior borders the upper peninsula of Michigan.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I guess
the weather's probably so inclement there on the lake too at all times that they probably required maybe more lighthouses or something. Who knows?
Yeah. The Edmund Fitzgerald taught us that lesson.
Right, exactly. All kinds of wrecks.
Yep. Well, thanks you guys for joining me on the show.
Sure. And
thanks everybody for sending in your questions. Once again, if you want to send in your own questions for the show, send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. Put in the subject line, it's a question for the podcast, and a word or two about the topic. That's always helpful. And we'll do our best to get to your question, or at least one substantially similar. Show only works if you all keep listening and sending in questions, so we appreciate you doing both. You two have a nice weekend. Everyone else, stay safe, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.